Hello and welcome to What's It All About, with me, Colette Kinsler.
And me, Sean Duke, where we ask fairly big questions and use science to find some of the answers.
There's one thing that unites every single person on the planet. Death. We all have to die. At least, that's the way it is for now.
Over the next hour, we'll be talking to scientists who are trying to figure out why we die and if we really have to.
I see no reason why there should be any limit to how long we can keep people healthy and how long they will stay alive as a result.
We'll also wonder, if you could choose to live forever, would you actually want to? And we'll even follow that infamous white light to try and find out what, if anything, awaits us when we do die.
Death itself is unlikely, in my view, now to be the end. I think one has to consider that consciousness continues.
We probably all have different views on what happens after we die. For some people, the idea of heaven is a great comfort. For others, the comfort is believing their atoms will be absorbed into the great wheel of nature.
Later on, we'll try and find out what science can tell us about the afterlife. But first, we'll hear from a woman who thinks she may have caught the slightest glimpse of that elusive realm.
My name is Gillian McKenzie, and in 1968, I had an extraordinary experience where I thought that I had a conversation with God and a dead relative, i.e. my grandfather.
46 years ago, Gillian was in labour with her first child. Her husband Hamish took her to the hospital where she developed severe complications. Straight away, she was prepared for a cesarean section and wheeled towards the operating theatre.
And I suddenly had this very odd feeling that my feet were getting further and further away, and that a feeling of, I can only say sort of energy, that's the only way I can describe it, was coming up from my feet, coming up through my body, and I was going out of the top of the head. He said, well, here is somebody you do know. And it was another male voice, and it was quite definitely my grandfather's. I said to my grandfather, I'm so pleased you're here. I mean, I can even get the sort of feeling now. And I said, but I can't stay. I've got to go back. And he said, why? And I said, well, to begin with, Hamish doesn't know how to iron his shirts, and I've left a whole pile of unironed shirts. I'm not sure what the explanation is. I'm more inclined to think it's something to do with brain function. If that does mean there is an afterlife, whoopee! If it doesn't, I shan't know anything about it anyway. I'm travelling hopefully, put it that way. But on the other hand, the side effects of that experience, here I am at 80, I have no fear of dying. I hope it's not going to be as painful as having a cesarean.
Unlike Gillian, many of us do have a fear of dying. But with every passing generation, in the Western world anyway, we become further away from that fateful day. There was a time when humans lived for an average of 30 years. We've long since more than doubled our life expectancy, and your children or grandchildren will probably live well beyond even 100.
But how far will all of this go? Will we reach 150 or even older? Will we even become immortal? Nick Bostrom is a futurologist, and he thinks about this type of thing all the time.
I'm a professor at Oxford University, where I direct the Future of Humanity Institute. This is a research institute where we try to apply careful thinking to really big picture questions for humanity. Questions like, are there threats to the survival of the human species? Is it possible that technology in the future will change human nature in some profound way? And what can we do now to maximize our prospects in the long term?
Of course, we are getting a bit ahead of ourselves here, in the sense that we haven't surmounted the biggest obstacle to achieving even very long life, which is aging.
But that's not to say it won't happen in the medium term. Because there are a lot of scientists out there working hard on that right now.
My name is Dr. Aubrey de Grey, and I am... Aging is actually a really, really simple phenomenon. Aging of the human body is exactly the same kind of thing as aging of a simple man-made machine, like a car. It's simply the accumulation of damage to the machine as a side effect of the machine's normal operation.
Aubrey and his team believe that there are seven types of cellular and molecular damage that cause us to age. So by tackling each of these in turn, they hope to actually cure aging. In other words, to stop or even reverse it.
And some of those sub-problems, if you like, are much nearer to fruition than others. In particular, one very big type of damage that we need to address is cell loss, cells dying and not being automatically replaced by the division of other cells. And the difficulty there is simply how to get those cells replaced medically when they're not being replaced by the body automatically. But we already have a very good technique for doing that. It's called stem cell therapy.
And one of the laboratories spearheading stem cell research is actually here in Ireland. The Remedy Institute in Galway is developing exciting new ways to use stem cells, not to reverse aging as such, but to develop innovative and almost futuristic treatments for illness.
It's a very interesting idea, and it's based on the following premise. Because we understand so much more today about how the human body works, then we can think much more about regenerating tissues which are damaged.
A key thing to understand is that there's no reason why there should be any ill health at the end of this extended healthy life. If we can keep people healthy for a lot longer as a result of periodic repair and maintenance of their molecular and cellular damage so that they retain the physical and mental function of young adults, then there's no reason why we shouldn't carry on doing it.
Well, should we be striving for immortality? My answer is no. I don't think it's a good idea. I think it would basically harm the human community. And I guess in the end, I think it's probably a good thing that we live finite, limited lives and pass whatever we've learned and our knowledge and skills onto the next generation. I like the very idea of a changing of the generations, in short. So immortality would create all sorts of problems. We already have 7 billion people on this planet, which is already creating a problem with global warming and lots of other issues. I got interested in these issues when I was in my mid-50s and mainly working on the cost of health care for the elderly and also end-of-life care, where that, of course, is mainly the elderly as well. And I sort of developed views in those at that point, which said we're going to have some limits in how much we can spend. Medical progress has its good side, but it also has its bad side in helping us to keep sick people alive longer and longer.
The history of humanity has been about stopping people from dying and getting sick unnecessarily, to the extent that we can. So I see no reason why there should be any limit to how long we can keep people healthy and how long they will stay alive as a result.
Perhaps one of the most interesting things about the drive for life-extending technology is, as scientists research ways to extend life in the future, they tend to come up with great new innovations that can be used right now to make life better for people with debilitating illnesses or disorders.
For example, earlier on we heard from Nick Bostrom, who predicted that humans will eventually become cyborgs. In other words, we'll merge with machines. But that's actually happening right now. If you have a joint replacement or an artificial heart valve, you're already part machine. But Liam Geraghty came face to face with a man who has merged even more deeply with life-enhancing machinery.
My name is Dennis Åbo Sørensen. I'm 36 years old. I'm from Denmark and I'm a real estate developer.
On New Year's Eve 2003, Dennis was about to face an accident that would change his way of life.
I was at a friend's place and we were celebrating like you normally do, and just after 12 o'clock we went out to put some rockets in the sky, and unfortunately one of the rockets wouldn't go to the sky and just blew up in my hand. tell that I was going to lose this because it was really not that pretty. So
Dennis did lose his arm, and 2 hours after he woke up, the doctor came in to speak to him.
So he just, in you can say in a hard way, but also in a very telling way, he told me that I could sit in the corner and cry and feel sorry for myself, or I could just take the challenge and say to myself that okay, it's my place from now on, and now I have to adapt to this. And yeah, I did the last one.
Dennis was fitted with a prosthetic limb, which he says was kind of primitive. From the very beginning, he became interested in reading as much as he could about bionic artificial limbs. He eventually came across an article that said a nearby university was helping in the first clinical trial to create a bionic hand. They were helping an international team, which included neuroscientists, engineers, surgeons, and robotics experts from Italy, Switzerland, and Germany. They were all working together to create the first sensory-enhanced artificial limb, a hand that would allow its owner to actually feel objects, feel what shape they were, if they were hard or soft. For Dennis, this is what he'd been waiting for.
I just picked up the phone and I started calling them, and they said, you have to wait. And two months after, I called them back again and said if there was something new. And yeah, then it ended up with a meeting, and yeah, suddenly I was a part of the project, and that was just amazing to be.
So we humans may have a rosy future to look forward to after all. And for many people, part of that future involves the next stage of life, namely life after death. A lot of people believe in some form of an afterlife. Around a third of people in Europe believe in something, and that figure is even higher in North America.
A recent poll in the United States shows that 81% of Americans today believe there is an afterlife, and 9% are not sure.
This is Melita Buchmann, and a few years ago she wrote a book about views of the afterlife in lots of different cultures, but from an unusual angle, economics.
I was thinking at some point, well, if economics really is everywhere on Earth, then isn't it also going to show up in the way human beings envision the afterlife?
So she looked at some economic principles and applied them to life after death. For example, if you take the concept of outsourcing, where a person or a company asks somebody to complete a task on their behalf, she found that way back in 17th century England, people were even outsourcing things like sins.
This is a time when Christians used to believe that if they had sinned, they would not have a good afterlife. They would end up in hell. One of the ways in which we know that people believe in the afterlife today, massively believe in the afterlife, is when we read reports from funeral directors who tell us in Western societies what people put in the casket before it gets closed. Reading glasses, or a piece of jewelry, or a bottle of wine. And I think that's a very telling thing to me. The fact that no matter how educated people are, no matter how modern they are, when it comes to this unknown, this ultimate unknown, namely what happens after we die, people want to be on the sure. People want to be on the safe side.
What happens, if anything, after death remains a mystery? Religious beliefs aside, there's no hard and fast scientific evidence supporting or disproving the afterlife. But that hasn't stopped scientists trying to find something. 30 years ago, a British scientist started researching near-death experiences, as well as what happens in the days, weeks, or even moments before death. But rather than providing clarity, What this man discovered has baffled the science world and disturbed skeptics. For example, some years ago, a woman had a small fall and broke her rib, so she was hospitalized.
Her brother came to see her. Her dead brother. And she talked to her dead brother, and when she told her daughter about it, they both joked that the dead brother had come because she was going to die, but she wasn't because she's totally well. And of course, the end of the story is that she did in fact die a week later.
That's Dr. Peter Fenwick. He's a consultant neuropsychiatrist at the Institute of Psychiatry in London. And his main interest is brain damage and consciousness.
And more recently, near-death experiences and what happens as we die.
And as a serious scientist, when he started researching near-death experiences, or NDEs as they're called, he was a total skeptic.
I thought they were rubbish, absolute rubbish. And I knew they only happened in California. I knew they were one of these exciting, overactive things and that they really meant nothing.
Until
I got a patient who had had a botched up cardiac catheter, his heart stopped, and he had a full-blown NDE. And so with this guy sitting in front of me, I had to start taking them seriously.
Now, this is where scientists tend to differ on why NDEs like this happen.
So I'm Stephen Lores, I'm a neurologist, and I work in the University and University Hospital of Liège in Belgium.
And Dr. Lorry studied more than 200 cases of near-death experiences in coma patients. He said they experienced the same things that Dr. Fenwick's patient described in his best case NDE. And Dr. Lorry believes these experiences can be linked to activity in particular brain regions. Take the feeling of bliss, for example.
But to understand this further, Dr. Fenwick decided to study death itself. And what he found has had a massive impact on where he thinks consciousness originates. Dr. Fenwick examined around 1,500 cases, and he found a number of very common experiences around death, which, when you put them together, raise very difficult questions about ideas of consciousness and ideas of life itself.
Some people, within 2 years, get a premonition that they're going to die. For example, a mother suddenly woke up with the feeling that her daughter was dead or going to die. And she found her daughter in bed beside her. The daughter was fine. 2 days later, the daughter was killed in a road traffic accident.
According to Dr. Fenwick, this experience is very common, as is the next phase called terminal lucidity, or what the Victorians called lightening up before death, just before you die.
Before you die, you come out of coma usually, recognize the family who are around you if they are, say goodbye to them. During that period, you'll see a dead relative who's come to visit.
Dr. Fenwick says this is very difficult for science to explain, as even Alzheimer's patients recognize family members who are gathered in the room.
And then,
the moment we've all been waiting for.
You die.
But that's not the end of it. Dr. Fenwick says there's another set of phenomena that occurs at the moment of death, beginning with the dying person visiting a loved one.
If they're awake, they will get this overwhelming feeling that something has happened to the person who's dying. Sometimes they'll see them, but that's not common. Sometimes they'll feel their presence.
All of these parapsychological phenomena around death are, Dr. Fenwick claims, very difficult to explain by neuroscience. And it makes us examine the very idea of consciousness. If it's not produced by the brain, then it's possible the brain merely transmits consciousness and acts as a conduit. This is called the transmission theory.
So if it's not created by the brain, then consciousness is a property of the universe as a whole. Now, as I've studied the actual dying process, it's very difficult to get away from the idea that death itself is unlikely, in my view, now to be the end. I think one has to consider that consciousness continues.